This is Mae Bressel, and this is side two of broadcast number 683, January the 7th, 1984. And now we'll go into some really heavy news. That there are very important stories coming out now, and they tie in. This half I'm going to talk more slowly because these are the parts and pieces that fit to the other broadcasts that I've had over the years. And I don't want you to miss the point of some of this. I don't think you do. But now I'm going to slow down and get to the nitty-gritty. Last week I was talking about the Flick affair, the scandal in Germany, Friedrich Karl Flick, funding politicians, the route of Mr. Flick with the Nazis, his father in Germany in World War II, the funding of Hitler and the munitions and the creation of the Flick Empire after World War II by our own corporation, setting it up as a buffer against the Soviet Union and immediately rearming Germany. And I referred to a story in the Los Angeles Times just a month ago that the Flick Empire that built itself up with billions of dollars of contracts now comes from the economic miracle of the 60s and 70s. And then I pointed out that the economic miracle was set up by the British and the American and the Canadian after World War II, within days of when the war was over, before we had bombed Pearl Harbor. And they set up these two companies. They had two different names. One was a British-American Canadian Corporation, formed in 1945, in May 45. And then when the CIA was formed, they changed their name in 1947 to World Commerce Corporation with the intent of building up Germany after World War II. And I also cited the Torbett document, that nomenclature of an assassination cabal written by an attorney in Texas on the assassination of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. It was mostly on the Kennedy assassination, but the corporations that were set up that would be used as covers for spying, that could be setting assassination teams to kill heads of states and other people all over the world. And in the Torbett document, Chapter 8, Section A, it begins with the Trial Club in Jamaica, the World Commerce Corporation, and links directly into the same people that were building up the German munitions cartel, were setting up assassination teams so that this long own Torbett document that I've had and used fits together with the CIA plans and the OSS, Mr. Donovan, and the heads of states, the American State Department, and the British intelligence, Mr. Stevenson, William Stevenson, probably the most important kingpin in all this, this saga. The assassination teams that I've referred to over and over again are identical with the corporations that were set up to rebuild Germany, and that is the story of what is bringing us to World War III at this time and the matter that I'll be writing about. Now, I had several passages I shared with you on the air, and there's one page that I want to cite. It's page 800 in the book, The Last Hero, called Wild Bill Donovan by Anthony Cave Brown. And he defines very clearly, and I've had this before with you, shared it. I want to do it one more time. It said one of the elements of the World Commerce Corporation was a commercial intelligence service based on wartime Anglo-American Canadian intelligence services, that they would have a combined spy service based on Canada, America, and Great Britain. It would now operate as a private commercial entity, and commercial entities plural. This was to be in every major city in America, in 47 countries, with the overt purpose of preventing the economic collapse of Europe without Germany, and the underlying purpose of preventing the Soviet Union from establishing Russian-German hegemony. That there's no way they were going to let Russia and Germany get along or trade or work with each other. And the World Commerce Plan was to frustrate the creation of this hegemony. Also, it was international, and it was to frustrate the intention of any country to coexist with Russia. If Andreas Papandreou wants to coexist with the Soviet Union, and believes that our foreign policy will lead us to suicide and murder and death, death of the planet, or most of us on it. The American intelligence, British intelligence, then will step in and take the proper actions against Mr. Papandreou. That's what they did with Mrs. Gandhi. She says, I want to remain unaligned. I want to get along with both of you. Then the business world, whether it's the Rewald in Hawaii or the Nguyen Bank that moved to Hawaii or the any of the major corporations, Bechtel or whatever you want to name, ITT or all of them, their role is to stop the getting along with Russia, which is exactly what they stated the purposes were. It has an overt purpose to stop economic collapse of countries, but the covert is to stop the coexistence with the Soviet Union, to supply the raw materials and make plants and facilities in Germany. This is what this book says, with the World Commerce Corporation supplying and arming them. And Mr. Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, of course, was playing a big role in that. That's from The Last Hero. So you take this goal. Overtly, you know, we want to stop a certain amount of combining with the Soviet Union. Covertly, you make sure that you use your armies to break them up if you have to. And that's what has been going on since World War II. Now, along those lines, and I repeat them because there's things that I've written in the past, and many of you say, write a book. And there's no evidence that you have used the information that I've written about, a lot of you. So I'm going to bring up certain points I've written about and then take the format of new material. Now, this past week, I got from the London Daily Telegraph an article. They're declassifying certain documents that have been locked up in the archives in London for 30 years. And the British papers now are running excerpts of these documents, declassifying them. Here's the latest, January the 2nd, 1984, the London Daily Telegraph. A gag on Hitler's will. It says, publication of a document described as the last political will of Adolf Hitler was opposed in 1954. They held it from 1945. That's the date that the war was over, and we started in May 45, and within hours, literally, we were rebuilding Germany. Great Britain had a copy of Adolf Hitler's will from 1945, of course, until 1954. That's 9 years. And at the end of the 9 years, they decided that they would lock it up for 30 years. They said they feared that the Führer's vision for Europe's future, resembled and coincided too closely with their own policy towards Germany after the war. Lord Simmons, the Lord Chancellor, said, there is some risk of foolish talk if in 1954 we publish Adolf Hitler's will because we're doing exactly what he told us to do and people will think he told us to do it. They said that it would be foolish because the German policy was made out by Hitler and von Ribbentrop. What they wanted, or professed they wanted for Germany, was spelled out before 1945 when he allegedly died, and I don't believe it. Then it goes on, however, he ruled out legal action, any legal action, because they were following Hitler's instructions and recommended persuasion to prevent publication of the views which were in the letter of von Ribbentrop, former German foreign minister, sent to Mr. Winston Churchill and Anthony Eden, the Foreign Secretary. The advice was given at a time when Churchill's government was anxious to support Chancellor Adenauer's attempt to put West Germany back on its economic feet. Chancellor Adenauer was related by marriage to Nelson Rockefeller, the David Rockefeller. And this is the time period where we had Reinhard Gehlen, knighted by the Vatican, working with the OSS, formed the CIA by 1947 when the World Commerce started, then he's to form his own BND, which is the German intelligence, and come back and be the head, like he was the head of Hitler's Army East Intelligence. Gehlen goes back, and Adenauer comes into office. And Hitler's will coincided so strongly that people would think that the British, and you also remember now, that the British-Canadian-American company, America and Britain, shared their intelligence, as of May 1945. So if Hitler set a will to Winston Churchill and Anthony Eden, he also set one to Wild Bill Donovan, who was working with Heinrich Himmler and SS Karl Wolff for about 2 years. The article goes on, the advice was given at a time to suppress it when Churchill, as I mentioned before, wanted people to support Chancellor Adenauer. Well, what about wanting to support Reinhard Gehlen? What if the will says put Gehlen in? What if he detailed? See, they've suppressed this because Hitler detailed it so closely. The Ribbentrop letter, although undated, had first been received in London June 17, 1945, 1 month after the British American Canadian Company was formed. 1 month after it was formed, they get a letter from Hitler telling them exactly what he wants them to do and what von Ribbentrop wants them to do. The American Canadian Corporation, the British American Canadian Corporation, formed in May 45, and in June 17th, a month later, for 3 days, they kept this letter. It was in London for 3 days, and after the foreign minister had been captured, von Ribbentrop, they kept this letter quiet. They had it 3 days. Von Ribbentrop was picked up, I guess, June the 20th, and so they couldn't keep his letter of recommendation of what to do. He was hung October 1946. And it goes on to say, in 1945, on Winston Churchill's instructions, copies of the letter were sent to Stalin and President Truman and circulated to the cabinet. But although the existence became known to the press, its contents were secret. I'd love to see the contents now. The existence is known to us now, but I'm waiting to see the contents. A full 5-page version of it is available now with a 4-line covering letter addressed to Field Marshal Montgomery, and it's in the Prime Minister's papers that have just been released under the 30-year rule. Although there's rumbling in tone and full of self-justification by Ribbentrop, the essence of the letter is summed up in this passage. In spite of all disappointment and embitterment about the repeated rejection of the German offers, that's Rudolf Hess, join Germany and go against the Soviet Union, join the fascists, he says, in spite of the disappointment and bitterment that you rejected our offers to work with you, the English-German collaboration has to be his last hour as the greatest of the philosophical ideas for the Führer. That the greatest thing he had was the idea that Britain and Germany should unite against the Soviet Union. It concludes, the war is lost for Germany now, as of June 17, 1945. In spite of this fact, I am the holy conviction, the religious, capital H, holy conviction, and by then, Reinhard Gehlen was just about to be knighted, or had been before, or working with his brother who was a knight. He said, I am of the holy conviction that the bringing about of a real friendship between the English and the German people is a fundamental necessity. The Führer is of the same opinion, was of the same opinion, and therefore has entrusted me to inform you. You know what this reminds me of? In volume 16 of the Warren Commission hearings, the first exhibit of those volumes, there's a letter that went to Ruth Payne, written, it was supposed to be by Lee Harvey Oswald, and Mrs. Payne delivered it to Marina Oswald, who was no longer living with her. They separated them after the assassination. And it was a list of instructions, unsigned, undated, for Lee to Marina. Here's where the safe deposit is. Here's the bank. Throw away these clothes. Save these papers. Save certain articles. It was the first indication to me that Lee Harvey Oswald might be alive and that a double was killed, because we saw a dead body there, but we didn't know him before. So if they say that's Oswald shot by Jack Ruby, you have to assume that he was dead and that this is the very same Oswald. Now, if he's going to kill the president, either he's going to be dead and won't need his clothes or papers, or he's going to be arrested and he can see his wife and tell her where the papers are. But it was a detailed letter with a very interesting kind of separation of what I want to keep and what you can throw away. And here we have that letter reminds me of this letter now, or vice versa, of what you have to do, 5-page detail, von Ribbentrop and Hitler. And we already, a month earlier, had an organization that was so well set up that it took 2 years to plan on rebuilding the Tysons and the Krupps and the Flicks to make the weapons, make the arms, and disseminate the missiles. And we have hundreds of bases in Germany at the present time, the American Army. But imagine keeping this secret 30 years for fear it would look like Adolf Hitler wrote the blueprint for the World Commerce Corporation. Well, I have news for you. I think he did. Now, another piece of history, and I'm going slow on this too. I have a desk of, you know, I bring into the station so much for 10 hours, but I'm going to go slow on this one. This comes out of the Jewish Bulletin, and I have to send for it. I just read it in a paper in Los Angeles. One of my favorite people, one of the most important people, I differ with several researchers on their importance, that is Henry Stimson, the U.S. Secretary of War. Henry Stimson is as important as Henry Kissinger, and they both work closely with the Rockefellers and Chase Manhattan. But this story is on the nefarious role of Henry Stimson. I've mentioned him before in conjunction with John J. McCloy and his importance in the fascist network, and I'll detail it again in case you don't remember. But this is written by Maurice Samuelson in the Jewish Bulletin, out of London again. Henry Stimson, U.S. Secretary of War in the administration of President Roosevelt, tried to prevent Europe's Jewish refugees from reaching Palestine or the United States and oppose the creation of the State of Israel. A new study has been published, and I'll have to get a hold of it, by the Institute of Jewish Affairs, a research arm of the World Jewish Congress. I get out of London, I suppose. Writing in the Institute's journal, Patterns of Prejudice, American Jewish historian Harvey Strum said that Henry Stimson repeatedly urged Roosevelt not to let any Jewish refugees into the United States. He opposed the efforts to persuade the British to lift restrictions on immigration. Don't let them in Britain. Don't let them in the United States. Don't let them in Israel. He said a Jewish state would be a threat to Anglo-American interests in the Middle East. We're going global after the war, you see. He has this important Secretary of War, but after the war, America's going to be right there in the Middle East with the Anglo-American interests. Under Stimson's leadership, the U.S. War Department repeatedly refused during World War II to disrupt the mass extermination of Jews by bombing the trains going into the centers of gas chambers of Auschwitz and the crematoria in Poland. He blocked it. He wouldn't bomb the deportation railways leading to the Auschwitz or gas chambers and the crematoria at Auschwitz or Treblinka or Dachau, any of them. Strum, who teaches history in Syracuse, New York, Onondaga State College in Syracuse, New York, has published articles on American anti-Semitism and bases his finding on studies of the Stimson diaries and papers at Yale University. For those of you in the East, you might start looking up this stuff at Yale University. The article reveals that in 1944, and this is important to that Hitler von Ribbentrop memo, I'm working up to that, in 1944, this is 1 year before the war was over, but it was the year that they were forming that Anglo-Britain Canadian corporation that became the World Commerce Corporation. In that year, he played a decisive part in dissuading Congress from voting for a Jewish Palestine. He had been a longtime friend of Zionist leader, Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter. Strum said Stimson was not a rabid anti-Semite. He didn't belong to anti-Semitic groups. He didn't wear, I guess, a swastika, and he didn't put on sheets at night like by the Klan. He was active in the United States with people who were Jewish, such as Felix Frankfurter, but he was appalled by the reaction of people to the Nazi concentration camps, and he refused to do anything about it. This person's writing about Mr. Stimson. Nevertheless, they find that for over 20 years, he privately opposed Jewish immigration to the United States, and a prospect he found as appalling as the Nazi persecution. In his diaries, it would be as appalling to bring Jews who were persecuted to this country, not anti-Castro Cubans, of course, you know, or the Premier Keys from Southeast Asia, the the Tsarist Russians who conducted the pogroms and all that. You know, we have certain refugees here. But he was appalled. It was as appalling to him as the Nazi persecutions were themselves. With the succession of Harry Truman to the presidency in April of 1945, Mr. Stimson advised Truman about the problem of Jewish people here, saying the danger was not over about American Jews, people who lived in America, who may meddle in the issue of how to deal with post-war Germany, post-Hitler Germany. The way they dealt with it was to lock up a lot of papers, as you see. Stimson was against punishing the Nazis for any murder of German Jewry. He was anxious that there not be a protracted denazification program that would drive the Germans into the Soviet camp during the Cold War. What it really is saying is that he was suspicious that the Jews in this country would be so appalled by the concentration camps that they wouldn't want ex-Nazis back running the government or people like Reinhard Gehlen becoming head of the German intelligence. Mr. Strum claims that throughout the debate over post-war treatment of Germany, and this is the decisions that were made, like what will we do in Germany when the British and the Americans and the Canadians were deciding with SS Karl Wolff and Himmler and Alan Dulles and Mr. Donovan. They were worried about the treatment of post-war Germany, and Stimson said the American Jewish community is powerful and nefarious, and their special interest group, and maybe the American national interest of the Jew would be in the pursuit of vengeance. Now, this is very important for all of you people and for myself to understand. There's a difference between understanding concentration camps so they never happen again and for having vengeance. You want to prevent the recurrence of it. And this man didn't stop it. And he wanted as many cooked as possible for his particular meal. Don't let them into Israel. Don't let them into England. It was Palestine in those days. Don't let them in the United States. But what will we do with the American Jew? Because they will interrupt us, and the American non-Jew may not want a denazification program. What do you do with these people? That was Mr. Stimson. And it goes on to say that blatant anti-Semitism, if it was blatant, often offended Stimson's conservative sensibilities. He belonged, I'm sure, to all Gentile clubs and so forth. His hostility towards the Jew was reflected in his conservative WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, dislike for Jews that was common among the U.S. elite and the general population in America. So they put the limit of 1920 to 1950. But if the WASP mentality isn't around now, then why do people like Gerald Ford and John Conley and Clint Murchison and Clement Stone fund people like the World Christian Broadcasting and try to convert the entire world to Christianity and not let people be whatever they want to be? Or why are they involved with people up in Idaho, such as Mr. Gilbert and Butler and the Nazi organizations? I will send for the longer documentation on this, but in essence, those two stories of the memo, the letter by Ron Ribbentrop, and Hitler to Great Britain and then to the United States, and the declassification of the Henry Stimson papers is a part of the material I've been covering from the last few weeks or couple of months on the getting down to the actual root causes of building up to World War III, secretly building the German munition cartels as they did after Versailles, and keeping it from us in any way for fear that in denazifying, the old Nazis won't have their jobs. And that's exactly what they did. They kept from the people, they didn't denazify, and they kept as long as they could a pacification, or maybe let the Jews have Israel. We'll arm Jordan and Syria and Saudi Arabia and all Egypt and all the other countries and wipe them out anyway. Let them have it for 40 or 50 years. Now, the Harper's Magazine in 1983 had a long story on John J. McCloy, which I have shared with you before, but in light of Mr. Henry Stimson, you might not remember the influence. And I'm just going to read a few sentences about this, because John J. McCloy was on the Warren Commission. He was related to Mr. Acheson, who Hitler and von Ribbentrop wanted in office, and they didn't want to blow that, evidently. And John J. McCloy has a history with the Pentagon and past Nazis releasing Mr. Flick and Frederick Flick, the father of the one who's now in so much trouble, or should be in worse trouble, releasing Hallmar Schacht, the German banker, and Hermann Abst, and Otto Ambrose. Our John J. McCloy worked hand in glove with those Nazis from the time of out of prep school, I suppose. But the man behind him was Mr. Henry Stimson, and the man behind Henry Kissinger, who I talk about so much, was John J. McCloy, along with Fritz Kramer. Just a few sentences from Harper's last 2 years ago, goes fast, February 1983. John J. McCloy personifies many people in the tradition of the lawyers, the corporation lawyers, who went on to Defense Department. They refer to Elihu Root, the corporate lawyer, former Secretary of War, Secretary of State under McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt. Root continued his experience and influence. He won a Nobel Peace Prize, and similar to him, and along with him, is Henry Stimson, McCloy's early sponsor, who he picked up John J. McCloy when he got out of Amherst and worked along with him. And McCloy worked with such figures as Dean Acheson, Robert Lovett, George Kennan, Averell Harriman, Douglas Dillon. They went from their law office to be power brokers to decide foreign policy. The same article says another person who owes his career to John J. McCloy's patronage is Henry Kissinger. Of course, Kissinger was in France from 1930 to 1940, and I'm suspicious of the contacts that McCloy had there that would possibly link to those people that brought Henry Kissinger to this country. The article goes on about McCloy being in Europe, sitting at the box with Adolf Hitler at the Olympic Games, meeting with Rudolf Hess. That's the fellow that wanted Hitler, his emissary, to go along with Germany to attack Russia. The British and Germans shouldn't unite. And this article tells about the role of Henry Stimson as one of the people who not only did not want to interfere with the concentration camps, and I mentioned this several years ago on the broadcast, but he was involved with McCloy, Mr. Stimson and McCloy, in setting up Admiral Jean Darlan of Vichy France, the Nazi collaborator who worked with the American government in North Africa. Now, one of the reasons Mr. Klaus Barbie hasn't gone to trial yet is that his attorney, Mr. Varger, will bring out the role of John J. McCloy and Henry Stimson and the Washington hierarchy, that when it was convenient for them, they funded not only Klaus Barbie, who worked for us, but the Nazi Darlan, the horrible person who was given sanctuary. That was part of the work of Henry Stimson and John McCloy, and they were working throughout the war and before the war and after the war with I.G. Farben, with the Nazis, and so forth. The time is right. Before I close, I just want to mention on last week's broadcast, talking about the Flick affair we mentioned earlier this evening, the role of Frederick Flick and their connection to the Nazis and J. Peter Grace and so forth. If you have the article I wrote in The Rebel a year ago, November 22nd, 1983, I have a section there on the Howard Hughes organization was a cover for the Kill Castro conspiracy. Howard Hughes thought it was patriotic. They retained Carl Boyer, associate, a public relations arm. Boyer worked with Nazi bankers and industrialists, the I.G. Farben interest. One of their clients was Mr. Schmitz of the I.G. Farben, and he's on the American Board of Trade. Their material was subsidized by the Nazi government. Then I go into George Sylvester Verick, editor of the German Library of Information, was in business with Boyer. A lucrative client was Frederick Flick Group. Flick, a Nuremberg defendant released by John J. McCloy, was the single greatest power behind the Nazi military muscle. Frederick Flick's son was close to W.R. Grace. He invested over 400, this is million, it was printed as 400,000, in partnership with J. Peter Grace in the United States. During the war, W.R. Grace was accused of, in a military report, of protecting a Nazi Colonel Bright in Bolivia. In 1951, when the CIA smuggled Mr. Klaus Barbie out of Germany, He was sent to the same Colonel Bright. George de Morenschild, who was Lee Harvey Oswald's mentor, was a close associate of the company's founder, William Grace. So if Flick is in the news now, and I wrote about Flick last year, Henry Stimson and McCloy are in the news again, and I wrote about Stimson and McCloy. And next week I'll do more on certain things that are in the news that I have shared with you in the articles I've written in the past, but they're very much alive. They're not over, they're current, and they're getting a lot of attention, and we will keep updating them. As I say, some of you don't remember that I wrote these things. You want me to write more. Let's go back and see what I wrote. You reread it again, then read your morning newspaper and see how pertinent it was, whether I wrote it 12 years ago, or 11, or 9, or 2, or 1. Read it now and read your paper and hold them side by side. This is Mae Brussel. We've got to close. Time is up. I'll be back with you next week. Take care. And if you want information how to obtain tape cassettes of this broadcast, you can write to me at P.O. Box 22511, Carmel, California, 93922. Remember, telephone conversations, try to limit it to 1 minute, from 8 to 9 on the weekdays, not the weekends, and printed sheets that are available that only accompany the broadcast, not separately. I'm not supplying those anymore. It takes too much time and energy to just answer all of that mail. This is Mae Brussel. I'll give you the address one more time, P.O. Box 22511, Carmel, California, 93922. If you're interested in listening to this, getting it available on other stations, or ordering a rebroadcast of this tape. Bye-bye. I'll be back with you next week. You too.